If you've been paying attention to the news at all, or if you're out from under your rock, you understand that the world is a crazy place at the moment.
Yes.
Lots of conflict and dangerous things taking place. Joining us to make sense of three of those different things this morning is the chair of the Department of History and Government and professor of international studies at Cedarville University, Dr. Glenn Dewar. Welcome back.
Great to be back. Good morning to you and your listeners.
So a couple of these dangers, I mean, we're also focused on Israel, and I want to get to that. But some of these, I think, generally people may be unaware of. What's going on in India?
In India, there are a range of different major challenges throughout the country. But most notably, when it comes to U.S. relations, there was the attempted assassination attempt of a Sikh leader within the United States, and it follows upon the actual assassination of a Sikh leader, Hardeep Singh Najjar, in Canada earlier this summer. And it has caused a very significant rift, in particular between the Indian and Canadian governments, less so between the U.S. and Indian governments, because the assassination attempt was thwarted and the assailant was taken into captivity. But it has raised alarm bells on just presence in the U.S., but also the safety of U.S. citizens who happen to support major issues like the independence of a region called Khalistan, which would be formed out of the Punjab state in northern India. And so there's a lot of tension right now between India and its allies in North America.
Now, those are extreme measures to have someone try to assassinate and assassinate, in Canada's case, a foreign, you know, leader, a foreign national. So what's the response been like from the Indian people in general, and then also from the Indian government to these extreme actions?
For the Indian people, they remember some major terrorist attacks, including the assassination of a prime minister in the 1980s, Indira Gandhi. And this was carried out by a terrorist organization that has been designated as such by many governments around the world, Babar Khalsa. And the question is, what level of connection do they have to other organizations that simply seek to support wider communities? In particular, there's a group, Sikhs for Justice, to which both men in Canada and the United States belong and lead. And in India, the government typically connects the two. Elsewhere in the world, they typically separate them out and say, hey, they're peaceful and they support the independence of this region called Khalistan. And it's their right to have expression and free speech and these types of things, especially in the United States and Canada, to be able to speak freely. But for the Indian government, it views this as someone that's trying to sabotage their country, someone that's trying to divide it and cause all kinds of rifts. And so that's a real sticking point at this stage between India, Canada, and the U.S.
Why do you think we haven't heard a ton about this in the U.S., even though there was an assassination attempt here?
There was a lot of news in Canada, and it's continued, and this rift really exploded over the summer. Trudeau and Modi are not getting along very well, despite the two countries being very, very good allies. In the United States, it really hasn't picked up a lot of traction between what's happening in Congress and what's happening in the Middle East. I think those stories are overshadowing it. But as you mentioned, this is an assassination attempt of a U.S. and Canadian citizen on U.S. soil.
Right.
Mr. Panem, and he has survived it, and so that's probably a big portion of it, that there's no death involved. But this is something very, very serious. I will say the other factor is that Modi has not clamped down as heavily on Biden as he did with Trudeau. But at the same time, in India, this is major news and major point of concern. But in the United States, this is an American citizen who had his life at risk and has the ability to speak freely and to have his position. And so it's trying to figure out, okay, what do we do with this politically? But you raise a really very valid question.
Shifting gears to South America, now I think it's pretty common knowledge that Venezuela has been a mess for a long time. And yet, I'm scratching my head here. What did they vote on recently?
It was a five-pronged vote on overturning a historical position from 1890 that granted Guyana significant territory. What is Guyana today? Significant territory in its west called the Essequibo region. And it comprises roughly two-thirds of all Guyanese landmass. But Venezuela for years has held out that it should have been part of Venezuela's territory, and it's very oil-rich in particular, so there's a greed aspect to it as well. But on Sunday, there were, just as you'd see on a ballot in the U.S., there were kind of five interconnected issues saying whether or not Venezuela had claims to it and whether Venezuela would mobilize militarily to take it. And overwhelmingly, on all five questions, 95%+ of people voted in favor. And so now the deep question is whether we will see military action on the part of a very radical and authoritarian government under Hugo Chavez in Venezuela to attack its neighbor. And again, like this story with India, it's just not gaining a lot of news in the United States. And this could be very dangerous because it could draw us in. It could draw in Brazil. We haven't seen this level of fighting really in close to a century in South America. And you have to go back to the 19th century to get something much larger and embroiled. So this is dangerous.
Now, for clarity's sake, if I'm looking at a South American map, Guyana is an independent nation, correct?
Yes. So you have Colombia. If we're moving from left to right across the northern part of South America, you have Colombia, Venezuela, Guyana, Suriname, and then French Guiana that belongs to France. And so this pertains to Venezuela, that is a significant size country that covers much of the northern part of South America. And then Guyana is an independent country. It was British. And then Brazil is below all of that. But it's a dangerous mix because Maduro is potentially moving troops even now. Whether or not he'll do something is another matter, but the fact that it has risen to this kind of level is dangerous.
And for us to understand clearly, essentially it'd be like the U.S. voting overwhelmingly to just take Mexico. It's essentially what's happening there, right?
Yes. And even in spite of the International Court of Justice ruling against Venezuela, basically, any time this has been taken to an international arbiter, they have said, no, it's Guyana's territory. They've had it. They've possessed it since 1890. That is even before they were independent. Venezuela has, under various governments, provided some level of tacit support for this, although that has been overturned under Chavez and now Maduro.
Wow.
But it's a massive portion of Guyana's territory. It'd be akin to saying the U.S. will take two-thirds of Mexico and we're just voting on it, and now what do we do?
And one nation essentially attacking and annexing another demands a world response, does it not?
Absolutely. And that was the brutality of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, because it overturned, really since 1945, a norm in international relations that we just don't act like Hitler in this type of way.
Right.
We don't just try to take territory. It's happened. There have been wars. There have been territories that have moved even outside of that. But it's been very rare, and it's typically been quite small. And it hasn't been this massive level of aggression as we've seen in Russia on Ukraine. And this could be a repetition of that, because Venezuela is much, much bigger than Guyana. Guyana doesn't have the resources really to defend itself easily or well, although I'm sure its people and its military will mobilize quickly and seek to protect it. But it's another very dire situation that's arising, and we'll see just what plays out.
We're talking about various dangers in the world, and we can't avoid talking about the war in Israel. What's your anticipation of how much longer this will go?
Definitely several months. I don't see this as a quick conflict, even though most conflicts between Hamas and Israel whether in 2014, 2018, or 2021, usually lasted about a week. Hezbollah and Israel had a conflict in 2006 that lasted a little over a month. But this is going to go a fair bit longer. I don't see it going into the years, primarily because there's a massive toll on Israel's economy right now. And the central focuses will be getting the hostages back and then trying to really secure that border, preferably probably trying to get rid of Hamas. But I imagine that there may be some level of compromise solution just as a practical matter. But this is going to continue simply because there are at least 137 hostages still held by Hamas and associated terrorist organizations in Gaza.
Now, you know, you hear folks opposing the war in Israel, which everyone certainly has their right to do that. I've seen various reasons. Some just would like peace in the world. Get that. Some are sympathetic to Palestinian people. Okay. I still do not understand the sympathy for a terrorist organization that's beheading children. Have you been able to figure out where that comes from and why people would support it?
In part, it's just news sources and where information is gleaned, because there is a much larger geopolitical issue, and Israel's not perfect by any means, but in general, it's been very, very good, and it goes above and beyond what others see. But I flew through the Middle East about a month ago. I was in Qatar and flying through, and Al Jazeera, that does have a level of nuance in its reporting, typically shows a very, very one-sided set of events. And so Hamas doesn't look like the aggressor in all of it. It looks like the government that's trying to protect its people from Israel bombing it. And those are the pictures that are constantly on the screens of Al Jazeera. The other side of it is other social media organizations, especially TikTok, that are reaching young people. And there's just a heavy, heavy presence that is very, very pro-Gaza and has completely not shown the brutality and the gruesomeness of what Hamas has done. And so some people may at some level be unaware of what they did on October 7th, the depth of the brutality, the invasion, the 1,200 plus killed, let alone the gruesomeness of the sexual violence that was carried out and the heinous nature in which people were killed. A lot of that has not been discussed fully or has simply been said it's part of a war. And in fact, that's not correct. That was a brazen attack that was not kind of considered by Israel as a starting point. Usually when Hamas attacks Israel, there's some form of policy change. There was nothing on October 7th other than the potential for a peace agreement bringing Saudi Arabia closer to the Abraham Accords. And it's really nefarious to see that brought down by Hamas.
Now, so you're saying that this sympathy for terrorists and sexual violence and murdering children seems to be a Middle East phenomena, and yet we're seeing some of it here in the U.S. Globally speaking, can you put your finger on a pulse of support for either side?
Certainly, it's very, very contested. I think there's a lot of sympathy for Israel, even in the Middle East, but that has vanished simply because of what you see on Al Jazeera and other networks. It's heavily, heavily one-sided. In the West, we have seen an uptick in support for the Palestinian cause. And not enough people are looking at the nuance between the Palestinian cause and the Hamas brutality.
Right.
Because there's something to be said for the Palestinian position. I don't agree with it, but I do give credit, especially since 2005. A lot of Palestinians have worked for peace. They've done a tremendous amount alongside Israelis, and Israelis have been very generous. But Hamas is a very different entity. It is a terrorist organization. It conducts very brutal attacks. It is funded by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran. And it's being allowed to perpetrate these types of things because it's carrying out Iran's ends. And it just there's a separation in the thinking between the Palestinian cause and Hamas. Those two are very different, but not enough people are gaining that nuance. And in the West, that conflation of support for the Palestinians and Hamas is causing, I think, a larger uptick in protests in the United States, Canada, parts of Europe that just haven't been seen in previous conflicts.
To what extent can you point to anti-Semitism as one of the causes of this?
It's very significant. I think it's a central one. I won't say it's the only one, because I think a part of it is, you know, there are Israeli policies that aren't perfect. There's also a level of jealousy in surrounding countries. Israel has literally made the desert bloom. It's become a high-tech hub in Tel Aviv. It's done a lot of tremendous things to export to the rest of the world. And when you're looking at Israel from neighboring countries, there's just a lot of jealousy because they've provided a per capita income for their population that is far, far higher than anywhere else in the region. And so anti-Semitism is a central one. It's a virus that has continued for many centuries, and we're seeing an uptick now. But there are other facets. I think jealousy is one. And I do think there are some places where Israel could make some differences, and it would help mitigate some of the tensions. But like I said, I go back to 2005, which was the end of the Second Intifada. Israel much better secured its area. There's been a decrease in terrorism. And a lot of Palestinians in the West Bank have provided an example of how they can operate. The unfortunate thing is in Gaza, when Israel withdrew unilaterally in 2005 as well, Hamas won the election of 2006, and they haven't held an election since. And not enough people are talking about that. Hamas is not only a terrorist organization, it's an authoritarian government that refuses to allow people to have a voice.
So I guess the last place we ought to go in this is, you know, as followers of Christ, it can be a little maddening when so many of the facts are unknown or ignored. Like, how do you navigate this as a believer when you hear someone subscribing to either vastly ignorant positions about Hamas or just factually wrong? Like, how do we talk to someone like that?
It can be very, very challenging, especially in the modern era where a lot of people will simply shut down. But I think your approach is exemplary, because what it does is it poses questions for people to answer and then consider. Because when you think about just factual information, if you were to take a Palestinian position and say, okay, I get these points, but you know, what is the answer to this? Or, you know, why then kill 1,200 people? Or why, you know, if it's a war, okay, I can see aggression, but then why carry out this level of sexual violence? You know, what about the rights of women? What about just helping and protecting women?
Yeah.
And I think these types of follow-up questions are useful. They're also less confrontational, because if someone makes their case and you explode and say, okay, you know, I disagree, you know, it's a fight immediately. I mean, that's how it tends to go. But measured questions that are pointed, that get to some of these larger issues, cause people to think, cause people to have to find an answer to it. And if they can't find one, it then hopefully produces a different outcome.
Good advice from Dr. Glenn Dewar, again, chair of the Department of History and Government and professor of international studies at Cedarville University. For more information, go to cedarville.edu. Again, cedarville.edu. As always, Dr. Dewar, I'm super grateful for your insights, your expertise, and your wisdom.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.